spirituality, consciousness, health, and mindset. Welcome to the Ascend Podcast. We're your hosts. I'm Chris Hopper.
And I'm Dan Harrison. Together, we are all wisdom, not excuse. Hey, what is up everyone? This week on the Ascend Podcast, we are joined by Mark Mabello, who is an author and a professor of history. And within this podcast, we explore some of the concepts that Mark explores in his incredible book, A Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife. And the book explores the afterlife traditions throughout history and examines beliefs from many different cultures on the soul, heaven, hell, and reincarnation. And in this podcast, Mark really brings forward and just has an incredible knowledge base in his mind and has really done some incredible research on many different traditions all throughout the human experience. So the other day I actually came across an incredible piece of writing by a guy called Andy Weir, and it's a piece that is called The Egg, and basically it discusses philosophical questions about death, God, time, and the meaning of life. And it's just an incredible little piece of writing, incredible, thought-provoking, beautiful little story. And the style that is actually used in this piece, it seems like it's actually been designed very intentional to sort of remind us that our experiences and our views are unique and that everyone is right in their own way. And what I like about it, what I really do like about it, is that the God in the story actually comes across as sort of a cool and casual and very human. So I was actually going to read it on here, but when I was doing some more research, I actually came across a little piece of audio which actually gives the narrator perspective of two different people. So just open up your sound senses and let your mind be absorbed in this little piece, as I really feel it sets the tone for this podcast.
What? What happened? Where am I?
You died.
There was a truck, and it was skidding.
Yep.
I died?
Yep, but don't feel bad about it. Everyone dies.
What is this place? Is this the afterlife?
More or less.
Are you God?
Yep, I'm God.
My kids! My wife!
What about them?
Will they be alright?
That's what I like to see. You just died, and your main concern is for your family. That's good stuff right there. Don't worry, they'll be fine. Your kids will remember you as perfect in every way.
Oh. So what happens now? Do I go to heaven or hell or something?
Neither. You'll be reincarnated.
Ah, so the Hindus were right.
All religions are right in their own way.
So what's the point then? When I get reborn, I'll just be a blank slate, right? A baby. So all my experiences and everything I did in this life won't matter.
Not so. You have within you all the knowledge and experiences of your past lives. You just don't remember them right now. Your soul is more magnificent, beautiful, and gigantic than you can possibly imagine. A human mind can only contain a tiny fraction of what you are. It's like sticking your finger in a glass of water to see if it's hot or cold. You put a tiny part of yourself into the vessel, and when you bring it back out, you've gained all the experiences it had. You've been a human for the last 48 years. So you haven't stretched out yet and felt the rest of your immense consciousness. If we hung out here for long enough, you'd start remembering everything. But there's no point to doing that between each life.
How many times have I been reincarnated then?
Oh, lots. Lots and lots. And into lots of different lives. This time around, you'll be a Chinese peasant girl in 540 AD.
Wait, what? You're sending me back in time?
Well, I guess technically. Time as you know it only exists in your universe. Things are different where I come from.
Where you come from?
Oh, sure. I come from somewhere. Somewhere else. And there are others like me. I know you'll want to know what it's like there, but honestly, you wouldn't understand.
Oh. But wait. If I get reincarnated to other places in time, I could have interacted with myself at some point.
Sure. It happens all the time. And with both lives only aware of their own lifespan, you don't even know it's happening.
So, what's the point of it all?
Seriously? Seriously, you're asking me for the meaning of life? Isn't that a little stereotypical?
Well, it's a reasonable question.
The meaning of life, the reason I made this whole universe, is for you to mature.
You mean mankind? You want us to mature?
No, just you. I made this whole universe for you. With each new life, you grow and mature and become a larger and greater intellect.
Just me. What about everyone else?
There is no one else. In this universe, there's just you and me.
But what about all the people on Earth?
All you. Different incarnations of you.
Wait. I'm everyone?
Now you're getting it.
I'm every human being who ever lived.
Or who will ever live, yes.
I'm Abraham Lincoln.
And you're John Wilkes Booth too.
I'm Hitler.
And you're the millions he killed.
I'm Justin Bieber.
And all the preteen girls that loved you. Every time you victimize someone, you're victimizing yourself. Every act of kindness you've done to yourself. Every happy and sad moment ever experienced by any human was, or will be, experienced by you.
Why? Why do all this?
Because someday, you will become like me. Because that's what you are. You're one of my kind. You're my child.
What? You mean I'm a god?
No. You're a fetus. You're still growing. Once you've lived every human life throughout all time, you have grown enough to be born.
So the whole universe, it's just...
an egg. Now, it's time for you to move on to your next life.
Wow, how incredible and trippy was that little piece there. So if you do want to listen to that again and watch a little animation, I've put that in the show notes at the Ascend Podcast website, and it's what I like about the little animation as well. It's quite cool because it actually uses little Lego men to sort of show the narration of the story, which is cool. So just before we jump this one, if you do believe in what we're doing and want to support the podcast, you can now do so by going to our Patreon page and checking out all the different reward tiers that we've set up for you. We even have a $2 reward tier, which gives you access to bonus content, special bonus conversations, and other rants that don't just quite make the podcast. And you might actually be thinking, what's the point in only donating $2 a month? But this is not the case, because if all of you who listen to this podcast just even donated $2 a month, we would be really able to take this to the next level. And we've also just added a new 1 hour bonus conversation to that Patreon page as well. So if you would like to check that out and all the other bonus content that we keep adding to the Patreon page, all you need to do is join the Patreon community and in the process support the podcast. And I just also want to say as well that we love that you are coming on this journey with us. We're a part of your journey, but you are also a big part of ours. So anyway, let's jump this one. Enjoy. By the way, as well, we, like I said before, we absolutely love your book, The Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife, by the way. And like I said before, we both haven't read the book fully yet, but we've both read probably about 30% of it. And we definitely plan on reading more and more later on in the future, because it's a fascinating book. And what's very interesting as well, when we were actually reading the book as well, A very interesting element to reading the book was actually me and Chris were reading the book at the same time when we were doing some research on you. And at that time as well, when we were reading the book, we were actually sort of throwing our own questions at each other via your questions that you were asking in the book. So basically we were just recording, it was like we were just recording a podcast like we are now, but we're doing it without mics. And it's very interesting. I mean, before we do start delving into some of them questions that you are asking in the books, I mean, you're somebody who is covering everything, just like we are with the podcast as well. You're covering topics from the afterlife, reincarnation, the soul, death, consciousness, culture, and I mean, I know as well, even in your book as well, you mentioned as well the simulation theory as well, which we absolutely love on this podcast. But I mean, what inspired you to dig into these heavy topics?
Well, first of all, I should mention that one of the reasons the book is so, shall we say, comprehensive, because I'm trying to deal with all times and all places and all spaces. I'm an old-fashioned generalist. In many respects, I belong to the 19th century rather than the 21st. All academics are just overly specialized. And there are a lot of bad books on afterlife concepts. And the trouble with that, I think by and large, again, the specialization. And everybody rehashes the same stale ideas. Well, I shouldn't call them stale because they're legitimate paths. But from the great world religions, and I try to, we know about 3,500 known societies. Obviously, I don't cover all of these, but the human experience with the other side goes back from to the beginning. They have found in Iraq Neanderthal graves. Clearly, the Neanderthals were burying these people. They even left flowers. They can tell that from the pollen samples that are on the site. Another interesting point, by the way, in these Neanderthal graves, they found apparently one of them was a woman who died during pregnancy or during miscarriage, and they gave her fetus a separate burial, which is quite stunning. Wow. Because again, in our culture today, I'm not trying to make a moral point, but we view this almost as a non-human. Yeah. But this goes back to the dawn of time. And curiously enough, we have never discovered a culture that does not believe in ghosts. In other words, it's a universal concept. Now, Darwin used to like to mention that we have cultures that we've known cultures that don't believe in gods. Now, again, that I think is quite surprising to some people. The Central Australians, and I've always been intrigued by them, the Aboriginal people of Australia, because they were living in a really harsh environment. And they may, their beliefs may indicate where the human race was at the dawn, at the start, the pure belief systems. And they don't have a God at all, yet they have ghosts and afterlife. And again, one of the points I try to make throughout the book, there's such a wide variety of notions. And I when your original question, why did I get interested? It is the ultimate question.
Yeah.
What happens to us? The Buddha has a wonderful line. He compares someone who doesn't explore the future, if you will, afterlife, is like someone who has fallen off a cliff and decides to enjoy the ride down or the trip down, so to speak. So we should all face these questions, all ask these questions. And sorry for my long-winded answer. You can tell the professorial background. I tend to do this. But the one important point, I think, and I want readers to be aware of this and also listeners, don't be put off by, it appears as if, for example, many of these ideas I'm discussing seem to contradict one another. One culture and one religion is telling you to do one thing. For example, cremation would be utterly abhorrent to the ancient Egyptians. Preserving the body was really intriguing, or I should say important to the Egyptians. And of course, to traditional Jews, embalming is horrifying to the body, which the Egyptians did. So you have these contradictory notions, but view it as the other side is a mansion with many doors. And obviously entering by the back way, it may be very different from entering from the front, but these are multiple paths. Once again, not to keep quoting Buddha, but he talks about the 84,000 paths of enlightenment. And that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to give people a sense of the many ways. Now, one thing that's kind of perhaps would be shocking to people is in the West, which we are highly developed in terms of technology and so forth and science, we are utterly impoverished and almost to the point of being simplistic when it comes to afterlife notions. People who go in that direction automatically assume that it's somehow tied to a god, somehow tied to ethical behavior, and somehow tied to there's rewards and punishments that are eternal. When in fact, again, I explore all this, that really doesn't apply in many, many cultures. In fact, the ethical component was especially intriguing to me because it only appears with civilization. Hunters and gatherers they basically don't have a place of rewards or punishments. The other side is basically a reverse version of this one. It's very similar. There are people there. They move around. They hunt animals. The Plains Indians, the United States, referred to basically hunting bison and drinking wild cherry juice. But once civilization begins and urbanization, you get the emergence of this ethical component, which does seem a bit suspicious because it's a form of social control. We're telling people, you're poor, you're miserable, you may be good. Well, don't worry, because in the afterlife, you'll be rewarded. And this billionaire named Donald Trump, he's having a great time in this life. Yeah. We're going to get him in the next world. So there's a sense of vengeance here. I shouldn't go on forever. I'll let you ask perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love that, by the way, as well. And you're right. You're right, Ramblon, because I think the question itself as well is a question that can't be summed up so easy. I mean, it's a big question that actually sort of that brings your whole journey together. And I don't think you can't really just answer that it opens up your mind, and you can't just answer a simple question like that in a sliver of a couple of sentences. So I love that, by the way, as well. And there was so much in that as well, by the way. I wanted to try and just dissect as well. I mean, and you wrote as well. You said before as well. You said these, when we're talking about questions, you said these questions go all the way back to the dawn of time, you're correct, and they do as well. And it also makes me ask the question: why does it go all the way back to the dawn of time? But just before we go there as well, I mean, it's interesting to me that people, all these questions that you have been asking through your research and the questions that me and Chris are asking as well, I mean, it's very interesting because people just seem to dismiss this without doing the due diligence on the research like you are. And I mean, the thing is, I was thinking about this the other day, if you think about this, our current worldview is incomplete and inaccurate in a certain sense, and it does contain a certain amount of delusion and illusion at the same time. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, because if you do think about it, to a sense, we live in a sort of we live in a world where our sort of a matrix of our current worldviews, that's the way I like to say it, and we sort of approximate our own truth. And when you do really think about it, no fully human being does actually comprehend what is going on in the universe. However, like me and Chris say as well, certain people like to think they do, but when people do, bad things often result when people do sort of become too certain in the beliefs. But obviously, as well as mine and Chris's journey is unraveling as well, the more that we're understanding, you should never be so certain. And I mean, us three here now, we love questions, and we know you should never be so certain, because we know that the world is just a complete endless and mysterious place.
Yes, and by the way, there's a professor, I believe he's at Rice University now, Professor Cripple, who talks about materialism is perhaps correct, but it's only half right. There's a tendency, well, not a tendency, it's basically fundamental to science, that only matter, energy exists. What we can perceive through our instruments and what we can see with our own senses, that's all there is. But there seems to be this important other component that must be studied. And I've always been intrigued. For example, we all are familiar often in pop culture, the stereotype of the fundamentalist, either in Islam, in Christianity, or whatever religion, who just rejects science as evil, as wicked, as useless. But they should study. If they're going to attack Darwin, read him. If they're going to attack modern physics, read the physics. But we have this reverse among scientists. I'm amazed how many highly educated academic types have, frankly, no knowledge of all of these beliefs I'm discussing. Mm-hmm. There's a story I've often told, an anecdotal story. This happened at my own university, a small university, Shawnee State University of the United States. I'm walking down the hallway, and one of my colleagues, who's a militant atheist, he has at that time his little 5-year-old or 6-year-old son, and he's standing in the door of his office and explaining the matter-of-fact tone, there is no God. Apparently the little boy had said something. And this professor was trying to tell him this is a mistake. And I remember stopping. I was kind of astounded by the tone and the direct nature of this, what he said. And I said, well, obviously, if there's no God, I guess Santa Claus and Easter Bunny are totally out of the question. And educated people should look on all sides of the question. By the way, I should also mention, when I mentioned earlier this Western obsession with simply in God and ethics and so forth, I was not trying in any way disparage that. That's a widespread notion that you can achieve salvation, even if you are a bad person or not very wise or intelligent, through the love, if you will, of a savior deity. The Hindus call this bhakti yoga. Obviously, we also find it in America, I should say Western civilization. Fundamentalist Christianity has the notion that you can be an evil, wicked person, but you can be saved through the blood of Christ. And they often give the example of the two thieves on the cross. The one fellow was a very evil person, allegedly, and he's being crucified with Jesus, but because he basically addresses Jesus in a respectful fashion, he receives paradise in spite of a life of evil. And in Buddhism, you have the notion in Pure Land Buddhism, there are many different types of Buddhism, if you say once in your life, Namu Amida Butsu, that's the Japanese version, which I'm, of course, rather butchering, you go to a Pure Land paradise after death. I should also throw in that there's a tendency for mysticism in the West, and to get all emotional and frankly wordy. I was always intrigued when I was doing the research. The ancient Egyptians discussed these concepts in a very matter-of-fact way. There's absolutely no mysticism at all in the Egyptian texts. That's how I tried to approach it. I'm not getting into abstract verbiage, just here are the facts, sir. That was my approach.
And I was going to chime in as well, Martin, by the way. I love that, and I think to get to that point as well is to get to that point and sort of open yourself up to new things is to ask yourself questions, and that's definitely what you were doing with your work as well. And just to spin it around as well, because I want to touch on a point in your book as well. I mean, in the first part of your book as well, you dive straight in with like one of the easiest questions of all. you ask the question, where are we now? And we love that question because it's just so open-winded question as well.
Powerhouse.
Yeah, it's a powerhouse of a question. And this question is a really interesting one to think about. And like I was thinking as well, I mean, Chris was talking about when reading your book, I was saying to Chris, we think we actually know a great deal with our sort of our big brains about the cosmos and about life itself, but at the end of the day, we don't know shit. And like you questioned in your book as well, you said this in your book, you said we're in a universe where we assume that we're living in the dead if they exist, or elsewhere. And I love that, by the way. And from that as well, you made another very interesting point. You said, what if we're dead right now? And you said, could the universe be a realm of the dead? And we absolutely love that. I mean, but what made you ask that question?
Well, actually, as you rightly point out at the very beginning, I thought the proper approach, since we're materialistic civilization, mm-hmm. or culture, is to first dismantle, to shake the boat, so to speak, mm-hmm. to let people know that all these pontifications by the scientists are basically just educated guesses. There may not be anything, and I don't really get into this at length in the particular, but natural law could just be assumption. It dates roughly from the 17th century, when in fact, whenever they observe things in nature, they tend to be approximations, and there tend to be exceptions to things. That reminds me of the famous white crow argument of William James, who was the professor, in fact, the father of psychology in the United States. And he said, all you need is one white crow to prove the exception. We all die, but it's possible with billions of people perhaps 35, 40 billion people have been born over history, that one person is genetically, shall we say, has a mutation that he doesn't die. He just his cells constantly replicate. We know that's possible because, strangely enough, that's what cancer cells do. Ordinary cells can only reproduce a number of times, duplicate themselves. But cancer cells go on and on and on and on. Why is that? Everyone listening today has encountered immortals. They're all over the place. We forget that bacteria are immortal. Immortal in the sense they don't grow old and die. Bacteria, kind of like pagan gods, can be killed, but they don't grow old and die. And their reproduction is interesting because it's duplication, in a sense, called fission. There's no parent. You have a bacteria, and then it duplicates itself, and they're exactly the same. And this goes on and on. So it's possible there's bacteria still here that have been very fortunate that go back millions of years. Now, also, the original notion, how do we know where we are now? This is, again, it's discussed anywhere from Euripides, the Greek writer, that this is the land of the dead. Now, this is based on the concept that, again, the Greeks notice this, they're very observant, that oddly enough, death seems to be pleasurable. This is especially obvious with violent death, not to get graphic on your audience, but they find executed men and also soldiers killed violently in a state of sexual arousal. It's rather peculiar. Why does that happen? And in the reverse, now we tend to focus for obvious reasons on the pain and discomfort of the mother during childbirth. But in fact, almost certainly, unless anyone's listening dies in sort of especially, colorful death, the most horrific experience we will experience in life that has already occurred was our birth, because we're in a dark, warm, comfortable place. And suddenly we're thrust into this loud place of disorientation and bright lights, and it must be really frightening to the newborn. In fact, there's a notion in Hinduism that the trauma of birth is such, that's why we have difficulty remembering previous lives. It's like someone in a horrible accident may develop amnesia. The same thing happens with birth. So since the Greeks noticed this rather, incidentally, there was a Damien Brinkley who has been interesting because he was struck by lightning and wrote a book describing the experiences where he died and came back. And he has a sort of interesting quote. He says, regarding death, he said, death is actually quite pleasant, even easy. It's getting there that's difficult. So again, we're focused on the suffering of the dying person. But once the death occurs, people with so-called near-death experiences talk about that all the pain stops, that all the discomfort stops, and suddenly they're in a sort of pleasant experience. So again, the Greeks noticed this and thought it's possible that we're misinterpreting what's going on. We think of the death as bad, but in fact, we may actually be, that's our birth into life, that everybody here is basically dead, and when we die here, we're born into life. Strange enough, Charles Fort, known for Fortean phenomenon, he often, of course, he's being very whimsical and he likes to pull the chains of his readers. But he suggested that he said the spiritualists are basically have it backward. There is an afterlife, but it's here. And when we die here, we're over there. And I also should mention in many cultures, there's a back and forth. In fact, we can even refer to the Greeks again. I always thought this was an interesting notion. The Greeks notice the parallel between an exceptionally old person and a baby, that someone who's very, very old is essentially turning into a baby. He's bald, toothless, loses control over his bowel and perhaps urinary functions. He no longer can form memories and loses them. Of course, infants can't form memories. He can't walk anymore. And they viewed that as an old person turning into a baby to be reborn. And that's a wonderful way to look at it, because when we see a very old person who no longer recognizes us, Perhaps we remember the young, beautiful woman or the athletic young man, and now the person seems enfeebled and can't walk and is disabled. What if he's simply being renewed and is getting ready to be reborn as a baby? Now, incidentally, I should mention in various shamanistic cultures in Eurasia, there's a concept very clearly stated that the other side is like a mirror world. So they would say that when we die here, we go over there exactly as we are here. So if we're 19 years old, killed in a car accident, we're 19 there. If we are 95, we go over in the appearance 95. But here's where the interesting part. Everything's reversed, including time. So the old person over there will gradually grow younger and younger and younger until eventually he turns into a baby and is reborn here. So the elderly person has some difficulties initially over there, but he has a longer stay. And I should mention, it's not a paradise. It's just a version of this world. So the original question, we could be dead now, that's possible because it's possible that the afterlife's not about sort of palaces and clouds, which we float on with, and we have wings. It could just be a version of this world. In fact, that's the most common idea about the afterlife.
Mm, I love that point of view.
And I should also mention, Christians in the West, and frankly, Muslims as well, we throw around ideas without really sometimes thinking them through. We talk about eternal life, and we talk about infinity. But it's possible that if you lived eternally in bliss, it could corrupt you. That's a concept found in Hinduism. If you behave yourself, you do some supreme act of generosity here, any one of your listeners could come back in his next life as a god, literally a god, Shiva, Vishnu.
And just to jump in as well, Mark, and I'm actually making the assumption now as well in my mind there. And me and Chris have already discussed this. What if we are already gods now? Because that's what I'm definitely thinking as well. And just as well to go back to the point as well, because there's so much in that again. Because I've got something to say, and Chris wants to say something on that as well. But before as well, a while ago you made a comment. You were talking about how it was a beautiful one as well, and you were talking about used technology of cancer cells and bacteria. And it's very interesting to me because if we take the astronauts. Perspective of the Earth now, and then we look at the human, like humans on the planet now, in a sense as well. I mean, this is a bit of a downer point, but it's just been real. I mean, we in a sense we actually look like we in a sense we could actually be a cancer to the planet itself. And I mean, we know what cancer does. Cancer eventually takes over the host and kills themselves, and obviously our host is the Earth. So I mean, it says to me in the future, if we don't sort our ways out, we could actually take over our host being Earth, and we could actually sort of suffocate and kill ourselves. And just to Chris as well, wants another point as well, which is a bit more of a positive point.
Well, yeah, something which was actually, it's been fascinating to me, and actually to go right near the start here to ask, like, when we're talking about the bigger questions in life, and to me it is like the most crucial question, like we've been discussing, is like what happens when we die. I mean, and many minds have tried to figure it out, and it feels as though like the general perception of death is like a bad thing. And it is interesting to me that when we look at these cultures who are asking this question deeply, like really looking into it, they did not perceive death as a bad thing. Like, they actually made the assumption that death itself was the most beautiful, rewarding experience. So I was just wondering, how do you think, like, people in the past, just like the ancient Egyptians, actually may have formed this understanding that death is a beautiful experience?
Well, I should mention, in fact, that's a really pregnant question, because there's so many, and again, I tend to go off on all these tangents, but I'll try to stay a little focused here. I should mention that there's a tendency among the few people like Raymond Moody, the noted MD, PhD, who wrote Life After Life, and he really introduced some of the, well, small minority of Western academics to researching so-called near-death experience. We have to be really careful because, now again, in the near-death experience, people talk about they're really in pain from the car accident or the illness, and then they feel this beautiful light, and they encounter what appear to be loving entities. What's interesting is, for those interested in, again, the afterlife trek, what happens. Some of those detailed information can come from what's called in the West the Tibetan Book of the Dead. There's also details and very explicit in the Egyptian, both the pyramid texts and then what happened. They come from the Old Kingdom. And then you have the emergence of the coffin texts, that's what we call them, and then the Egyptian Book of the Dead come in the New Kingdom, the coffin texts in the Old Kingdom. All of these are literally guides to what goes on the other side. And if we get back to the Tibetan notion, when you die, according to the Tibetans, you encounter the clear light of the void. And it's like a million suns and a million lightning strikes. And now it's not that you're a person walking into it. You're literally, it's all around you. And you appear bodiless. It's as if you're pure consciousness. You don't even have a dream body, as it's called. And most people will shirk back, because they're frightened by this. And if they do that, they will continue the journey, and I call it journey loosely because it's not really a journey, but it'll go up to 49 days. And in the initial part of this, now again, it's all based on your level of enlightenment and knowledge and so forth, you will experience these really beautiful entities that seem to be embracing you. And the Tibetans say very clearly that the entities you experience will be based on the contents of your own mind. So, for example, a Christian would see angels. Perhaps a Muslim would see an Archangel Gabriel, perhaps the prophet. A Jewish person would see these angelic beings. A Hindu would see his gods and so forth. But they say, do not really embrace these entities because they're not really there. Now, I know that sounds curious, because in the West, we think, wait, this is all a hallucination? Mm-hmm. Well, yes, but I want to make it very clear that in the East, they have something called non-dualist thought. This entire world we're in right now is a collective dream, if you will, a hallucination. And it's not really real. We just think it is. Now, you may say, how could that be? Well, recall your dreams last night. They seem very real. But they weren't, we think, although they may be as real as this universe.
Yeah,
I should also mention, by the way, curious thing about dreams, and you compare them, everyone notices the parallel between dreaming and the near-death experience. It's interesting that, now in the best cases, people that are born blind, when they dream at night, they're still in blackness. Their dreams, they hear things, they smell things, they touch things, but because they were born blind, they don't see things in their dreams. But these people born blind, when they have well-documented near-death experiences, see in these near-death experiences. I think that's quite intriguing, and perhaps the best evidence that this is not simply, a hallucination, which a lot of Western scholars say, well, you're getting a shortage of oxygen to your brain. That's why you're seeing all this. Now, getting back to Tibet, they say don't be drawn to these beings because they're really not there. They're from the contents of your mind. And then several days into this Bardo experience, especially three Bardo states, you start to see hellish beings, and they start to do nasty things to you. Now, again, if someone is not properly prepared, they may think they've been damned to hell. Well, be careful. This, again, may simply be part of the process. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead says, do not be afraid. These entities are not real. One of them will tear off your head, rip off your intestines, eat your eyeballs. But they said, do not be afraid. Be calm. Now, that's a very Eastern notion, calmness, equilibrium. Don't be drawn to anything. Don't be afraid of anything. Don't revile anything. Simply remain calm. And then as you get to the end, those who are not going to achieve nirvana will be reborn in one of six possible states. And then they detail and I give these in a very, sort of cliff note version of what you have to see, the various colors, what you'll see. For example, you'll see a kind of a darkness burning, a wood fire, if you will, and then you'll hear beautiful music. Strangely enough, that's drawing you to a hellish realm. You have to be careful not to go there. If you see palaces, you'll become a god. But the point I was trying to make, we don't really know. It's possible that death itself, even though the initial stages seem to be universally kind of rainbows and kittens, mm-hmm. but in some traditions, it will become frightening. But you must not be afraid.
Yeah,
you must be brave and courageous.
Yeah, Mark, I love that as well. And as well, when you made the point there as well, you made the point that death actually could be actually births into other lives, which I think is beautiful. It's interesting to me to think about how that actual understanding that people have talked about for millennia, how that understanding of death can actually be transitioned over to a modern human being's mind. I mean, I was actually thinking about this. I mean, if you think about it now, most sort of civilization now that we're in now builds the emphasis and has this belief around death sort of being this final chapter. In a lot of people that me and Chris as well come in contact with, mm. a lot of people turn around and just say, oh, death's just black and that's it and that's all they say. But they don't really think about it like too much. I mean, even if you just look at a funeral as well in modern day society now, we have a funeral and the whole concept around the funeral is sadness and mourning. But I still think if we actually had the understanding that, I mean, the understanding that me and Chris have now, that we know that energy never ends. In a sense, the experiences that me and Chris have had, we know we're not our bodies. And we know that consciousness, well, we don't know, but we have the sense and feeling that consciousness doesn't reside in the brain. I mean, that says to me that shouldn't death be a celebration, and it should be a celebration of the next chapter. I mean, this is a side note from this as well. I mean, do you think in the future, when science does continue to improve and technology advances, we actually may be looking at a very different model of death?
Well, I should mention, and this is an important one, there's a widespread concept. It's found in the West by some of, sadly marginalized figures, but also in the East, that you will encounter what you expect. Now, you said a lot of people are thinking that death is simply blackness and non-existence. Mm-hmm. Now, that's actually a dangerous idea from the point of view of the afterlife, because literally that's what they will experience. A hard core atheist, when his consciousness continues after death, he can't believe he's still alive, because he's so convinced there is no afterlife. So he will think he's in some kind of coma state. He's in this darkness. Nothing's going on, because that's what he thinks. And this idea that the afterlife is generated by our own expectations. And this is also based on the idea, if we're generating the universe with our minds, perhaps we're generating the other side with our minds.
Yeah, I was going to jump in there as well, because you made a very good point. I wanted to add something on my mind there, because when you were saying there, like, does it matter if we actually believe in afterlife? Because like you said there, it is true, because if you think about it now, we know that in the world now, our thoughts create our reality. So who says our thoughts wouldn't transcend over the afterlife?
Yes, yes. And by the way, I actually knew that I end the book with a statement. I do the famous, do a version of the Pascal's famous question, or his wager. He was, of course, one of the fathers of probability theory and mathematics, and also a philosopher, ethicist, 17th century Frenchman. He was doing it in terms of the Christian God, but I kind of paraphrase it. If there is no afterlife, and you're an atheist and free thinker, and you think that's what you want to believe, if you're right, and there is no afterlife, you gain absolutely nothing, because you'll be in the same position as everyone. But if there is an afterlife, and you insist on not looking into it, the possibility of denying it, the consequences could be calamitous. And this is, again, Pascal's wager. The gambling man or the gambling woman will put his money on afterlife, because you can hit the jackpot. There's the potential that you can hit a jackpot, yeah. But you gain nothing from, again, this extreme free thought and denial.
Yeah.
Well,
I was just going to jump in there, because jump back as well, because obviously I got you off track a bit. Yeah. But just to jump back on the question as well, because I'd really love to see your thoughts on it. I mean, do you think in the future, when science does continue to improve and technology advances, I mean, we know in the future that technology is getting better and better, and science is starting to sort of get better as well. I mean, do you think we could be actually looking at a very different model of death? Because I would love to see your thoughts on that.
Well, I tend to be in this position a little of a pessimist, and I'll say no. And the reason I say that, now, incidentally, as I mentioned earlier, I'm a generalist, and I've also done a lot of reading history of science and so forth. Historically, periods of scientific achievement normally don't last more than about 2.5 centuries. And then it becomes, it sort of petrifies. And I think we're going to have this again. Now, I'm certainly much older than you two gentlemen. When I was a child, when I was born, hate to admit this, I was born in the 1950s. Growing up, we all thought we'd have flying cars by now, and we'd have cities on Mars. And it's unbelievable how the scientific advance has rapidly is slowing. Now, again, the propaganda machine talks about all these wonderful achievements, but oddly enough, one historian of science, and I sadly forget his name, published an interesting article some years ago and said there have been actually no new innovative ideas in science since the 1960s. I know it sounds stunning. All they're doing is improving upon earlier technology. The computer is old. The microwave is old. Strangely enough, the cell phone is actually just a glorified walkie-talkie that goes back nearly a century. And of course, the satellites are from the 1950s. And scientific advancement is actually rapidly slowing. Also, there's a tendency, and this happened to medieval scholarship. When you got medieval scholasticism, you get the emergence of experts, and you get, in our terms, peer-reviewed journals and full professors with tenure. And I guarantee you, you try to publish a really groundbreaking scientific article, it'll destroy your career. In the last 100 years, there's only been one paper published, and it was decades ago, challenging fundamental notions of Darwinian thought by a scientist. And today, I'm not trying to say that we should challenge Darwin, but if you try to challenge the ruling paradigm, they won't give you your PhD, and you certainly won't get tenure, and you won't get published. This happens in physics. This happens in every field. So I think it's rapidly, and also everyone's becoming too specialized. This happens in the field of history. In 1890, I believe there were perhaps 20 professional historians in the United States. That's it. Now we have thousands, and everybody's doing more and more on less and less. When I was doing my research, I was stunned that I had to often, for example, in the field of anthropology, use older works because the modern ones were virtually useless because they were so worried about political correctness. For example, the Central Aboriginal people, again, of Australia, which I highly admire, they did not count past three. They had no need for mathematics. And I was reading a modern book, and this anthropologist says, they viewed reality in terms of trinities and dualities. Well, I mean, okay. Well, so to get back to your question, I think it's going to start to slow and petrify, and perhaps the hostility towards the other side will increase. I certainly view this in academic circles. We have at my university a philosophy professor who is known. He's frankly got a religious background in Christianity. And he's constantly getting into scrapes with colleagues who, in sort of email exchanges, are ridiculing his positions. And then I think this will increase. There's an arrogance that in the materialistic worldview. And we see this all over the place. And one thing that's really alarming to me, and both the United States and Western Europe in particular are part of this, our value system, we're exporting Western values, even as Western civilization is collapsing around the world. And we're insisting that the only way to do things is the way we do it. And we're destroying cultures and worldviews. We can clearly see when the Spanish did this in the 16th century, they did it because they were absolutely convinced that Catholicism was the way, the truth, and the life. And by destroying the Incas, their civilization, and the Aztecs, they were saving their souls. Well, Americans in particular do this. You have to have our way of life. Now, we think of it as good. We're helping these people out when we build schools for girls in Afghanistan. But if you look at the textbooks we're putting in those schools, and it's our value system. One academic historian has suggested that America does that because when New England lost its religion, it turned to moral crusades. For example, they began with obviously attacking slavery in the South, and now we're into, again, other ideas. But we have to leave people alone and cultures alone and religions alone. We can't be certain that our way is the best way.
Yeah,
the Spanish were, but they were wrong. And we are wrong, too. So I don't think, in fact, we have the means now to have sort of astral psychonauts who could explore in laboratory conditions near-death experiences. I make a reference in the book to ketamine, which was accidentally discovered at the University of Michigan in the 1960s. It's infamously now used as a date rape drug, but it was first used as anesthetic for soldiers in Vietnam. And what it does is the mind seems to become disassociated from the body, and you can perform surgical procedures on the injured soldier, for example. And the scientists didn't even really notice that another staggering effect of this is people were talking about going to the other world. It's as if ketamine was releasing their consciousness. Now, you had a wonderful academic, and I highly recommend his books. He was at Oxford. I think he was a psychologist, David Fontana, who sadly passed away. And now he tends to focus only on the Western traditions, but he gives really detailed concepts of ghosts and apparitions and specters and afterlife and post-death communications. He suggested before his death that what ketamine was doing, that there is some brain chemical that keeps our consciousness in our bodies. And then when that's sort of neutralized, the consciousness, shall we say, pops out. And that's why they were having these near-death experiences. But we could do this right now, explore the other side.
Yeah.
And we should be. But it is happening on the fringe. But, of course, they're being ridiculed and ignored by the mainline culture.
Yeah, and Mark, as well, just to jump in as well, because I want to get a good point what you said there about exploring the inner world as well. I mean, as well, you said obviously technology is not advancing and things like that to obviously what you expected, sort of. See, I mean, let's say that obviously technology or science doesn't get to that stage and doesn't validate the concept of death to the human psyche, and like you said there, exploring the inner world. I mean, have you ever thought about how this new understanding of death may actually be transitioned over to modern human minds? Do you actually think that it'll be actually exploring the inner world, just like there's mention in ancient scriptures about how the ancient Egyptians were taking psychedelics, or they were actually sort of doing accessing other altered states of consciousness to actually achieve this understanding? I mean, because a lot of people as well sort of see technologies as sort of outside of ourselves, but a lot of people don't actually realize that some of the best technologies in the world are the conscious technologies that we have in our own body. So, I mean, could you see that as a way in the future, actually, how this could actually be transitioned over to a modern human being's mind?
Oh, by the way, I seem to recall, didn't you recently have a Dr. McKenna on your program?
Yeah. Dennis McKenna, yeah.
Yeah, now that was the brother of Terrence McKenna.
Yeah.
And of course, he was interesting. It's been years since I read both the brothers, but I remember the now deceased brother who encountered, again, in the Amazon, I believe, he was an anthropologist, and he was suggesting that we should have these psychonauts that were basically under controlled laboratory conditions take these hallucinogenic substances. Now, I should mention, and this is really an important point, it always struck me as rather curious that almost all Western vices today are based on religious activities originally. Gambling was originally a method of drawing lots and so forth to determine the will of the gods, and we've turned it into gambling. Dancing, not to call dancing a vice, but it's this was not simply jumping up and down to music. Even today in voodoo, the drum beat is the voice of the Lwa. These are the gods. And normally in traditional dances, it's carefully choreographed. They're acting out religious legends. It's not just jumping up and down to the beat. This is degenerated. And you have drug use. No one in traditional cultures would think of taking hallucinogens at a party for fun. It's the flesh of the gods they're consuming to have higher experiences. Also, even alcohol, especially in northern European cultures, you had the Vikings, who viewed basically alcohol consumption as a form of communication with the divine. The Greeks, for example, actually thought that when a person became intoxicated, he was actually possessed by the spirit of the wine. They viewed the juice of the grape as the blood of the wine, and many cultures think the soul is in the blood. That's actually a Jewish concept. That's why they can't eat animal blood in kosher practices, because the blood is the life, as the Torah says. That's the Old Testament, five books, first five books. So so I have a feeling, again, it would be interesting to use these substances under control conditions for research, but it probably would be abused because they would be looking for the wrong things. And really, it's important. Our culture glamorizes scientific research, but you can only see what you're looking for. And we forget this. They will say in science, and again, Charles Fort, I'll mention him again, notice this. Modern quantum theory talks about that electrons moving from within the atom from A, point A to B without moving in the space in between. They just seem to be here at point A, here at point B, and they don't move in the space in between. And that's taught in the textbooks. But if someone teleports, which is essentially what that is, from Brazil to Spain, he's ridiculed. They say that can't happen. It happens at the subatomic level. Why not at the higher level? So there's a tendency. It's possible that we're actually getting information, but we just can't possibly interpret it correctly because we tend to interpret the unknown in terms of the known. Modern people keep referring to the brain as a computer. Well, nobody said that until the last few decades when we developed computers. And in fact, if you read people in 1900 science, they tended to view the brain as a radio, which I think is interesting, because that was really, to them, advanced technology.
Through frequencies as well, wasn't it?
Sorry?
Through an understanding of frequencies as well, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. And I've mentioned earlier in this discussion, William James, the psychologist, I always thought he had an interesting notion. He thought, and again, he's the father of psychology in this country, my country over here, that the brain does not have a productive function at all. It has a transmissive function. Now, in his day, the really high tech was the transatlantic cable. At one point, it could take months to send a letter from New York to London. When they put this cable down the Atlantic in the 19th century, you could virtually instantaneously send a message from New York to London, which was just amazing to the 19th century. Well, according to William James, he suggested that what the brain really does, it's not producing the mind at all. It's simply the network where the mind communicates with the body. And if now, you'll know, if, and he gave the example, he could give the example later. If you give a radio to a traditional person who's never seen one, he'll think the voice in the radio is coming from the box because he notices when he plays with the dials, it changes the quality of the sound and the voice. When he destroys the box, the sound stops. And I think perhaps modern scientists are making the same mistake. Yeah. They'll see head injuries and they'll notice it changes the person. And they notice when the brain is destroyed, it appears that the person is dead, but they may just be messing with the wiring, cutting the transatlantic cable, to use William James's analogy. And this is really important. I think you mentioned earlier that perhaps both of you have had out of body experiences. This should be explored because it would be really firm evidence that we continue. I should mention, there's another Western concept we have to be really careful. It's probably because of our Judeo-Christian background. We can't be certain that if we continue to exist after death, we exist forever. Everyone always jumps to the conclusion it's eternity. Although among the Aztecs, rather curiously, the regular people survived for 4 years. Those who died, women in childbirth, that was viewed as a heroic death, men in battle, men on the sacrificial stone, went to the sun where they had a glorious existence. But those who died ordinary deaths, sickness and old age, made a really difficult journey for 4 years. And then when they got to this place of the Lord of Death, Mictlan was his name, if I remember correctly, they turned to mud. Now, of course, that's obviously social engineering there. They're trying to encourage people to die in childbirth and in battle and on the sacrificial stone. That's why they made the ordinary death as bad. Yeah. Similar things found among the Vikings. Die in battle, go to Valhalla. Ooh. Die in straw death, go to a boring place. So Helheim.
I've just a point like here that I've just actually been simmering on there, and I couldn't hold it back any longer because it's been itching as to sell to Europe. You know when you were touching on like Terence and Dennis McKenna there, and when we were talking to Dennis McKenna, actually he was talking about how there could be a connection between psychedelics and creating your own religion, and I think as well. It actually made me think as well how the spiritual awakenesses was from ayahuasca and plants itself. And it made me actually think, do plants themselves have a spiritual connection? I mean, to death. Like, do all creatures with consciousness have this, like, spiritual experience of an afterlife? Or is it just, like, limited to humans?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question and a fundamental one. You see, I was at a conference recently in Portland, Oregon, where one of the most popular speakers was a pet psychic. I was there with academics and psychologists and historians and physicians, but the lady who really packed the audience in was you could talk to Fido. Now, not to be, again, sarcastic, but there in many traditions, yes, animals and frankly plants do have this. Now, if you get into Eastern traditions, anyone listening may, their next life, they may come back as an animal or a plant based on karmic activities now. Although it's viewed as a really low thing to do. In fact, if you come back in Hinduism as an animal, it's going to take you, if I remember correctly, about 8 million lives to achieve human status again. Mm-hmm. You've done something really poorly. Now, back to your original question, I should also mention that we no longer do this. But in Renaissance era science and religion, they actually thought that minerals had a form of life. There's this really interesting, beautiful notion that metals grow in the earth. They would find veins of gold, and they thought that there were golden trees growing in the earth. And when they found nuggets in rivers, they thought this was the fruit of these golden trees. Now, modern science says, oh, no, all the gold, silver, metals were produced in supernovas. By the way, that's a recent idea. We've only come up with that one in the 20th century because we had no other explanation where these metals come from. So they said, oh, it must be a supernova, a star exploding. And kind of curious to me why these minerals or metals are become concentrated in certain locations. And then we rip them out of the earth. Now, in Roman times, they would close mines before they were exhausted because they thought the minerals would grow back. Wow. And we're just completely, now not that the Romans were right and not that minerals are going to grow back, but I have a feeling that perhaps we're approaching this incorrectly. But you can come back in Jainism, which is a religion in India, as a mineral or as a crystal or as a metal. That's again, Western scholars refer to this as animism. The whole world, the whole universe is alive. And of course, they dismissed it as primitive in the 19th century because they noticed little girls talk to their dolls. And they said that's what primitives were doing. They were talking to trees. But to dismiss primitive perhaps is correct because perhaps they were the ones who wandered far from the truth. And by the way, it's a wonderful notion in Eastern thought that as the older something becomes, the more corrupt it becomes. It begins new and fresh and pure, and then it ages and becomes corrupt. So when they talk about the world ending, it's not a final end, it's a destruction because it's kind of a canker-ridden, sore-ridden, diseased world from it grows old and bad, and then it's destroyed and renewed in destruction. Similar concept is found in Odinism, the idea of Ragnarok as a form of purification, or among the Hopi Indians. And I should also mention, remember we said before that you can only see somebody if you look for it. And I talked about how we call the mind a computer because we have computers. It's interesting, and I talk about this in the book, that hunters and gatherers have this entirely different worldview from the farmer, who has a typical different worldview from the modern factory worker or the modern industrial economy. And that's not coincidental, because the questions you asked are based upon your old experience. That's why the hellish underworlds are found only among the farmers, which is interesting. And underworlds in general are typically, although not uniquely, but typically found among the farmers. And in many traditions, the dead never leave this world, which is interesting. Melanesia in the Pacific, they go west, but they remain on the planet. And interestingly enough, and I should mention, if your listeners are interested in these concepts, you have to be really careful when you read Egyptologists today, because they often, they're so specialized, they're missing points on world religions when they're discussing, and they're just puzzled by what's going on in Egypt, because they've never seemed to apparently taken a course in traditional religions. Well, in Egypt, the person dies, and then they gave the analogy in ancient Egypt, every morning the sun is born from the womb of the sky goddess, and he travels across the sky in a celestial boat. The ancient Egyptians had no bridges, interestingly enough, or roads, because the Nile was the perfect highway. The currents went, the winds went one direction and the currents went the other.
That's beautiful, and by the way.
Sorry?
That's beautiful, by the way.
Yeah. Yes, and if you wanted to go north or south, you just either used a sail or flow with the currents. Well, they viewed the path across the sky as a celestial Nile, and then the sun god died in the arms of his mother every night. He grew old and died. And then he boarded, if you will, his body was put on a boat, and he traveled across the underworld. Now, 19th century scholars thought they were looking at the Egyptian hell. Budge, the famous British Egyptologist, wrote a work on the Egyptian heaven and hell. It was completely misinterpreted as he was seen, because he was had this tradition in Judaic Christianity. But in fact, what happens is the sun god, he journeys through the underworld, and he experiences dangers. He has to pass through certain gates. He needs secret passwords. That's found all over the place, including in the modern Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They give people passwords to get into the highest heavens. And of course, when they do that, they're ridiculed by outsiders, saying, you stole this from the Masons. That's not what they're doing, because we find passwords all over. The cult of Orpheus in ancient Greece gave you special words to say. This is found in ancient Egypt. And then you go, the gates are anywhere from 9 to 12 in number, and they're guarded by monsters. And the information in the Book of the Dead, or in the coffin text, or in the pyramid text, is to help you navigate through these dangers. And if you're successful, or I should say if the sun god is successful, he is reborn in the morning and joins the living again. And then they develop the concept that that's what the dead do. They join the sun god in his bark, travel across the underworld. They must know the passwords to navigate the dangers. And then if they are successful, they come among the living every day. The Egyptian family was such a strong notion, it triumphed even over death. They rejoined the living. So they never really went elsewhere. They remained here. And that's a common concept. Incidentally, 19th century people, Riemann, the German mathematician, came up with the notion of higher dimensions, non-Euclidean geometry. And that's led to the interesting speculation that the dead, and frankly even gods, could be in the fourth dimension or higher. And they're really literally a few inches away from us at some level, but we can't see them or experience them typically because they're in the fourth dimension. So, and also I should mention in Jainism, I mentioned it earlier, their idea of the loka, which is the universe, includes everything, gods, as well as the dead, as well as the living. And this idea that the dead are outside is rather peculiar, which most Christians, I should mention, don't realize this. Medieval Christians thought that the God was in our universe. They thought at night, if you went out and looked at the stars, which they thought were all at an equal distance in a crystalline sphere, if you looked beyond that sphere of the stars, and they thought they were all together because they moved together, God was there. And in medieval thought, now they would have thought that a spaceship would be impossible, but if you could hypothetically build a spaceship you could visit God. Now, I found it, I have a course in my university on alternative religions. I've always been intrigued by, in our own time, Heaven's Gate. That was that suicide group in the 90s in the United States. They resurrected the idea that the heaven, if you will, and the God are actually in our universe.
Yeah. But the I'm just going to jump in there as well, because you said a really interesting point, and I want to ask you a question from that as well. A very good point when you said that you made the way you're talking about how they were making the assumption that heaven and God is already in our sort of what was the word you used? You said in our universe. That's what you said, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's very interesting to me because it's interesting to me because me and Chris have thought about this, and we've actually asked ourselves. Mm. Like, what if we were had a picture of heaven in our minds, what would it actually look like? I mean, I want to ask you that as well, but for me and Chris anyway, heaven would, for me and Chris, we've discussed this, and heaven would be exactly where we are now. So on this planet now, we have the ability to, I know there is sort of war going on and things like that, and there is people who struggle and things like that, but at the end of the day, if a heaven was completely perfect, I think as a human being now, I think I would come to the understanding that in life there needs to be a balance between like the yin and yang. So in life now, we have the ability to taste, we have the ability to touch, we have the ability to have sex, we have the ability to do all these different amazing experiences, even talk to you on a podcast and delve into an amazing mind like yours. There's multiple sort of sensations that we can pull on from all over the place, and to me, heaven seems like where we already are now. I mean, I would love to ask you this. What does your heaven look like?
Well, I'll quote the great Argentinian writer Borges. He referred to it to be a great library. That was his idea. He was the National Library Director in Buenos Aires. And I love books. I like study and I like writing. So heaven would be, frankly, a really similar to this world with a really big library. And I owned all the books. And I can mark them up at will because I like to annotate in books. And the idea that, again, the heaven has to be, or hell, very, very different from these places, that doesn't really attract me. I like to think of, because we're both talking in terms of, we both have probably relatively comfortable lives and so forth, and we like where we are, and we want it to continue. As you said earlier, someone in a horrific zone, in a war site, it not going to want to do this. And by the way, another point, you mentioned earlier how we can be viewed as a cancer of the human race because we're multiplying out of control, destroying the planet. When I referred earlier to, again, some of these traditional peoples, I didn't mention the Khoi Khoi in Namibia, but I mentioned like the Aboriginal people or the people on Andaman Islands in the Bay of Bengal. We forget, even though when the British arrived, they dismissed the Aboriginal people as this almost animals, very backward. If that's where the human race remained, they would live here indefinitely. They were in perfect equilibrium with the world. And we're clearly, if we keep going the direction we're going, we're going to destroy it. There's just far too many people multiplying far too quickly. Our agriculture is especially alarming because it's out of control. We're producing huge crops, but we're just destroying the topsoil and everything else. And by the way, it's getting so serious, and I'm paraphrasing a Canadian researcher in agriculture science. He pointed out that if we tried to feed the entire planet on organic farming only, which is where everybody was in 1900, that half the human race would have to die. We couldn't feed them. Yeah. And I really don't think, it's my own perhaps personal prejudice, but it's not floating around on a cloud singing church hymns. Yeah. Although strangely enough, the really only description of heaven in the Christian Bible is actually in the book of Revelation. And it's actually describes this powerful God with all these archangels chanting. So it's possible that's what's going on. That always reminds me of the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, who had a sort of famous statement. He said as a child, he was terrified of going to heaven because he was in church every Sunday and he thought it would be an eternal church service with all the doors blocked. That's how he was afraid heaven would be gone.
It
was terrified.
Does sound boring, doesn't it?
So, but everybody, and I think that's why variety is important, because again to plagiarize Swedenborg, everybody has their own ruling love. I've done some research on various neo-pagan religions, such as Odinism, the Odin Brotherhood. Now, I don't find bikers in that group, but when I go into other Odinist groups, often they're biker types and like to go to bars and get into fights. They're Hell's Angels, we call them in the United States. That certainly would not be a heaven for me, but it's a heaven for these guys. So who's to say? And again, my original point, we talked about not exporting one value system around the world. Yeah. There's a wide variety of opinions. And I think rather than trying to reduce everything to a simple formula, we should appreciate that there are differences and different desires and different needs. Eric Hobsbawm, the late British historian, once pointed out that real revolutions are Puritan in nature. He said the hippie revolutions of the 60s were play acting. I think he was absolutely right. And we're probably witnessing on the planet now new revolutions. We just don't recognize them because we're so immersed in our own value system, we can't appreciate that other people could have other ideas.
It's very interesting because when you were saying there, we can't notice other things in the world and notice new ideas. And I think one of the reasons that I'm seeing anyway that a lot of people can't see them pathways in the mind is because the focus is on them topics. Like the focus is on the sort of the bad that's going on in the world. Like the news constantly all the time is constantly brainwashing people, saying it's bad, fear. But for me and Chris as well, I mean, we've gone through a period in our life where we've completely, I mean, you may be the same as well, but we've completely sort of just, like, we don't pay any attention to the news at all or anything. And our world and our universe in which we exist is completely different now. I mean, we're not even on the frequency where there's not even a percentage in our mind that's even thinking about it. So I think for a human being on this planet, I think you've got to build that sense where you've got to build that platform and you've got to cultivate that understanding that don't put your mind in that space.
Yes, exactly. It reminds me, in paleontology, there's the notion that dinosaurs grew their entire lives. A lot of reptiles do this. They just kept getting bigger and bigger. And frankly, that's in a physical sense, but that's what humans should do in a mental and emotional sense and a spiritual sense. Now, again, you two are young men, you have developed, and hopefully when you're my age, you'll also be elsewhere. I'm certainly not where I was when I was 30 years old. And I like to think that the growth and development continues the whole way. And again, that's why there's a path of yoga called the pursuit of knowledge, Nana Yoga. And I think that's the most important one. Just more and more information and have the hunger for learning. And obviously you two are going in this direction. Yeah. So that's applauded.
As well, just to jump in as well, Mark, as well, because it was a point I wanted to ask you before as well. I mean, you're bringing forward so much amazing information. And obviously there's just so much in this. It's amazing. Like, someone's going to have to listen back to this loads of times, and ourselves as well, because it's just so much amazing content. But just as well, a question I wanted to ask you as well, obviously it's a big topic, death as well. But I was actually wondering sort of any of your personal experiences. Have you had any certain experiences where that sense has actually come through to you that there is more than death? Because, I mean, me and Chris have both had experiences. I mean, even just the sense of I had a, not to go too much into it, but I had a lucid dream. And that I had a very, very interesting experience with a lucid dream. And it gave me the sense that, give us a sense that I'm not my body. And it made us actually, it gave us the pretense in my mind that maybe consciousness does extend far beyond sort of space and time. I mean, have you had any experiences of that, like any sort of physical experience, like out of body experiences or things like that, that may have also in your life that's come up?
Well, a couple points. One is, in both I mentioned earlier, the deaths of my mother and father. Yeah. In both cases, when they died, I knew it. I was in the University of Glasgow in Scotland when my mother passed away. And my father called that she was really ill, and I got onto a train to go to London to leave out of the airport, the quickest flight, because the Prestwick Airport didn't have a one coming up. And while on the train, middle of the night, in a sleeper car, I had, shall we say, a kind of experience with her. I was with my father. I was living now in Portsmouth, Ohio, and he was living in southern Michigan, 250 miles away. And when he passed away, once again, I had an experience. Now, that's called, in traditional lore, a wraith. They say most of the intelligent contact, by intelligent, I mean not just a ghost doing the same thing over and over again, it occurs within about 24 hours of death. And that's what I had. Now, in my own case, a personal experience, I've not had a, now, not to personalize all this, but I did receive in 2013 a cancer diagnosis, and at one point was given just maybe 2 years to live. And oddly enough, in the process, I simply decided to get my book finished and get married and buy a house and thought I have to grow up and take care of things. Mm-hmm. But I don't really fear it. And I don't really want to leave prematurely, but I will like to think that when the time comes, I will face it calmly, with a sense of adventure. It's the ultimate journey, and it's not simply we're not simply turning into ozone and fertilizer, as the materialists would say, but we're being released into a higher adventure. And that's so I look forward to anticipation, but I've never really had, which would sound curious for someone who has written on these subjects, perhaps the direct experience you've had with the, out of body experience. Now I should mention, I did have years ago, a kind of curious dream, which is, now I only saw it for what it was, not that I was becoming this, but people will say that when they have a dream and they always wake up before they die. Like if you're falling off a building, just before you hit the ground, you wake up.
Yeah.
In a dream that I had in the 1990s, I actually died. I was actually shot, of all things.
Wow.
I was tied to a chair and gunned. And I remember feeling the bullets go in, and they felt cold, which is odd because bullets would allegedly feel warm. And I die in the dream, and then after I'm dead, I wake up. Now, that's intriguing. And I remember thinking at the time, because that's a kind of a shaman's dream. Not that I'm a shaman, but that's shamans literally go through the death experience and then come back. So that would be the probably the closest. And again, a materialist would just miss that as, oh, well, I had too much to eat before I went to sleep.
We don't listen to them.
Yes, but I felt it was a significant experience at the time. Who knows what I will experience in the future. I do have a strange sense. One thing that's always been interesting to me, and I remember talking to my dad at length, and we find this among the ancient Babylonians, it was found among the Greeks, it was found among the Nietzsche, the German philosopher, is the idea of the eternal recurrence, which is also found in this Odin Brotherhood group that I researched. And it's the idea that time is a circle. Now, the ancient Greeks said that the only things that are infinite and eternal are circles or cycles. Geometry talks about a line going on forever in a straight line. Well, the Greeks said not really, unless it's a circle. And it's the idea that in a finite universe, if you have everybody, I should say there are finite possibilities. If you have a finite universe and eternal time, repetition has to occur. And if you imagine, and it really is true that if you put a chimpanzee in front of a keyboard and have him typing, randomly hitting the keys, he will eventually produce, it may take billions of years, but he will produce all the plays of Shakespeare because repetition has to occur. And as I like to tell my classes in a lot less time, Donald Trump's book. But this is the joke there. But not to pick on the Donald, interesting guy. But at any rate, I do have a feeling that I've done this before. That that my life has been exactly as it was before. That's what the eternal occurrence is. You have the same parents, you grow up in the same experience, and you when you die, it eventually will repeat. It's a strange form of immortality. There may be trillions of years before this universe resets up again, but we will come back. One oddity is, when I was a child, my parents thought it was really odd behavior. I did a lot of odd things as a baby and a child. I would rock my head back and forth constantly when they put me to bed, and they couldn't stop it. rocking back and forth. And I am ashamed to say I did this into a really advanced age. I was probably still doing it 10 or 11 or 12 to fall asleep at night, rocking my head, moving, rolling my head back and forth on the pillow. And what's curious about that is when I got this multiple myeloma diagnosis, I can't move my neck. My head is always straight forward. Again, I turn my body like a turtle when I talk, but it's, or I should say a lizard, but it's stunning to me that did I somehow anticipate there'd be a time in my life when I couldn't move my neck?
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Mark, I was wondering, just jumping as well, Mark, do you have a question, a side note from that, do you have many occurrences of deja vu? And also as well, another added question to that as well, on top of that, in the research that you've done, because you've dug into many different research and you've pulled from all over the place, I mean, in the past, is there much information on deja vu? Because even in the modern day era now, there's not much information on deja vu. In deja vu, obviously we know a lot of people talk about how it's associated with sort of something that we've done before, and obviously parallel, and a lot of people go even deeper and talk about parallel universes and things like that, and we all connected and things like that. I mean, do you have many occurrences of deja vu and things like that?
Yes. Yeah. Normally, although I should mention, the reason I wouldn't really discuss them at length is because people always think it has to be a dramatic experience. Yeah. I have them all the time, but it's normally just something I'm doing that's very normal behavior.
Yeah.
I'll be walking down a hallway and I'll think, oh yes, I remember doing this the last time I was here. Now it could be I mentioned how we tend to see based on our worldview, I'm interpreting what's occurring based on this sort of idea in the back of my head that eternal recurrence is real. But I have them all the time. Mm-hmm. I should mention in the 1920s, there was an American researcher who claimed that that when we dream, we're often, all of us, now this is not strictly deja vu, but are actually seeing glimpses of the future. But he said the reason we don't realize it is because it tends to be maybe 24 to 36 hours into the future. And it's just something we're doing order. For example, you go to sleep tonight, and then you dream that you're eating a sort of bowl of Weetabix at your kitchen table. But you don't think it's a sort of prophetic dream because it's just an ordinary experience. But in fact, I think his name was Dunn, if I remember correctly, this fellow wrote this book. And he says we see them all the time. Now, there's this notion, and I also talk about this in the book, of block time, which is intriguing. This is an Eastern concept. It was discussed by McTaggart in Britain in the early 20th century. And it's also discussed in Slaughterhouse-Five, the Kurt Vonnegut novel, that all time exists always. That's an intriguing notion, that right now somewhere your great-great-grandmothers are two-year-olds playing on the floor. Yeah, and so in a sense, when we die here, block time is real, there's no passage of time. Fred Hoyle, the great British astronomer, seemed to be convinced that he's best known for coining the term Big Bang Theory, which he thought was not true. And I don't think it really is, by the way. The reason they come up with Big Bang Theory is because they have a Judeo-Christian background. There has to be a beginning of the universe because we're coming from that tradition. But at any rate, he was known for steady state theory and astronomy. And he thought, I forget the title of his novel. He writes a book about block time. That all times exist simultaneously, and that in a sense, what we are these reality worms, that it would go from birth from the womb all the way through everything you do in life and then into the grave. But then when you die, you immediately start over again without interruption. You become a baby because all times exist. That's a really interesting concept to me. Now, again, some people would say, I want to do something different or go other places. But it's, if you enjoy life, it's a wonderful idea. I should also mention that Uspensky, and your listeners should take a look at his work, The New Model. I think it's called New Model of the Universe. He was best known as the follower of Gurdjieff, although I often find him more interesting than Gurdjieff. But Uspensky was this Russian 20th century man who not only believed in block time and this endless repetition, but gives you ideas, and I talk about it in the book, of how to escape from it. if you're so inclined. And he said the only way to do this is you can be reborn into the past, not the future, but the only way to do it is to change yourself. See, his argument was we do the same thing over and over again because we're the same people in the same circumstances. That's why I'm always making the same choices. But if you can sort of consciously will a different decision, you can be reborn into another life, if you're so inclined. I would enjoy coming back as who I am. But he was talking about the possibility of escaping. Now, you can only do this where vacancies occur. And these are people who either have moved on into other lives or spiritually died. He talked about people who sometimes the soul dies because they kind of degenerate. And he says one way to recognize a person on this level is when they have fabulous success without virtually any effort. They're perhaps near the end of this. They're basically, it sounds curious, but they're declining. So again, the Facebook founder and all these other guys perhaps are going to be in big trouble. They have to be careful, according to Ouspensky. But again, there's so many different ideas out there. You can find one and direct attentions toward it.
Yeah, Mark, as well, I just want to say as well, there is so many different ideas out there, and you have actually just brought so many amazing ideas that we love to explore in this podcast. Yeah. And by the way, we'll wrap it up for now, but honestly, Mark, I'm saying it now, you're going to have to definitely come back on the podcast again in the future, because yeah. I know as well, for a fact, you've said so much amazing information. I've got so many other questions I want to ask
you.
And Chris has got so many questions he wants to ask you as well. And we're at the 1:30 mark now. And I think for a lot of people's minds out there, this may be enough to digest for now. But honestly, Mark, I think in the future you're definitely going to have to come back on the podcast because honestly, wow.
Next week.
Yeah, next week. What a powerhouse, honestly. So much body of knowledge, and backed up with so many interesting information. You can really tell that you've done a lot of amazing research. So I want to just say thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing all the work that you have done over the years. Thank you so much.
Thank you, brother.
Well, thank you for having me, and it was an honor to be on your program.
Yeah, again, like from the 20 millionth time over and over again, just like the podcast.
Yeah.
Just like the block time.
Yeah, just like the universe. Yeah. Parallel universes.
Done this millions of times over, and thank you again.
Thanks so much for listening, and please check out Mark's book, Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife, which is an absolute incredible read. And also consider supporting the podcast by joining the Ascend community and becoming a Patreon member. And if you become a Patreon member, you will gain access to a private Facebook group where we all connect and discuss many different questions. You'll also gain access to bonus content like bonus podcasts and other rants. So if this does tickle your fancy, please head over to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/ascend and join the community. And I just also want to say that we appreciate and love you all, that you are all coming on this journey with us. We're a part of your journey, but yous are a big part of ours. So anyway, we'll catch you next week where we have another amazing episode.